This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart. Coming up, just how great are Fiji Airways' financial woes? A coalition of the willing featuring leading MPs pledges to reverse the cycle of gender-based violence in Papua New Guinea. And we explore the lofty ambitions of the PNG think tank group, which claims it can influence government decision-making. Those stories to come, but first, the Australian gunman who murdered 51 people after attacking worshippers at mosques in the New Zealand city of Christchurch in March last year will spend the rest of his life in jail. The whole life term with no prospect of parole was handed down for the first time in New Zealand's history after a four-day sentencing hearing. Three of those who died in the massacre were originally from Fiji and included Imam Hafiz Musa Patel, the long-time leader of the mosque in Lautoka. The president of the Fiji Muslim League, Hafizuddin Khan, believes the sentence may go some way to giving victims' relatives a sense of justice, but he says the impact of that day will live with them forever.
Well, that's the maximum he could get, and I guess it's sort of a closure, but as much as a closure can be, these kind of things, you lost lives, innocent lives, people are, I think, still grieving, and it's still a difficult situation, of course, but the fact that the authorities have done the maximum they can do, and the New Zealand government and the country has done the maximum it can do is, in fact, a major relief, I think, to the people.
People often talk about closure in cases like these, and with a sentence of that magnitude, perhaps that word closure will come into the debate. But as you've already hinted, perhaps those that were affected and those that you know of, I mean, they will never get over this, will they?
No, they will never. They will never. There's a lot of pain, and which goes without saying. And I think it's very difficult for us, as much as I am part of the institution of the community, it's hard for us to still tell them how the individual who has lost a husband or a son or a wife goes through with it. We can only try and understand, you know. So it's difficult for us to say closure. It's easy for us, but it's not that easy for them.
For the Islamic community in Lautoka, I mean, how have they coped with losing their imam?
Well, it was difficult because, he was very much revered. He was here for 25 years, but he had left with the intention that he would probably not come back. But there was always hope because he had left his stuff behind that he might change his mind. So he had a lot of following. A lot of people still have very fond memories, and I think they will for a long, long time. So, they're overcoming it, but it will take time.
What about the impact on you personally? Because clearly there must have been an emotional impact, but by the same token, you had a job to do to try and help people heal.
Yeah, it was difficult. A group of my colleagues and I rushed to New Zealand and were there for the funeral and also the ceremonies in Christchurch. And it was a very difficult period. And of course, adjusting to it afterwards, because, there were always concerns that, for the security and the local government as well in Fiji and the security forces were very prompt in making sure that, there were no Me Too stuff going anywhere. But thankfully, it was all managed pretty well. But yes, it was a difficult time. It was very traumatic for all of us.
And for a religious man, what are your feelings about Tarrant? Do you have any feelings about him? Do you have any understanding as to why he would do something of this nature?
Well, it takes all sorts to make this world. And, for every million people, I'm sure there's a thousand crazy people around. And I would say in every community, or it doesn't matter which country. So what propels them? What compels them to do what they do? I guess psychiatrists and psychologists can try and analyze this for people like us from a very humble background. It's very difficult to understand. Maybe a fruitcake? What do you call him? I don't know.
And if there was one positive to come out of this situation in the immediate aftermath of the shootings, it was the way that there was a multi-faith rallying around, if you like. This wasn't just about one religion. This was about many religions coming to the aid of Islamic people affected by this shooting.
Yes, as I said to the people here when Jacinta Ardern visited us in February this year to commemorate at the mosque where the imam had been the leader. And I said, it was a very memorable and notable occasion for me because we were late for prayers for the Juma at Christchurch, and people and there were thousands of people who were thronged there recognized who we were, and from our dressing, I guess, and worked so kindly in terms of making room for us to get through to meet the prayer in time. We just made it, and it's the humility and the love and the kindness of people and the charity that goes with it was well displayed by everybody. And Australia and New Zealand is very strong in these sort of things, so we're very appreciative of that.
And some of the victim statements that have been read out over the last couple of days during the sentencing hearing have been heart-wrenching, to say the least. Do you consider what's happened to have been an enormous test of faith for somebody like yourself and your followers?
Absolutely. It is a test of faith. But nonetheless, all it does is it makes you feel stronger that there is somebody up there. And one, there's justice. And number two, people are all one, because regardless of which medium of faith that they choose, at the end of the day, they're all creation of the one true God. And it was very humbling and very, very comforting to know that our faith in our religion and the faiths of other people who joined us were, if anything, it was reinforced.
Do you think that what has happened in any way has helped people outside the faith to have a better understanding of what Islam is all about?
Absolutely. I think there's so many people, thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people in New Zealand alone who came to the various memorial ceremonies and even donned the type of gear that's required just to be inclusive. It made us feel that was probably a huge opportunity for us to explain to people who probably never have had any opportunity to try and understand. And it was in that way a very fortuitous occasion for us. Yeah.
Just deeply sad that it happened in this way and under those circumstances.
Absolutely. But I think Islam has been better appreciated and understood in New Zealand at least, and I think in Australia as well since then. Maybe the world over. Who knows?
That's the president of the Fiji Muslim League, Hafizud Din Khan. We stay in Fiji, where the leader of the Unity Fiji Party, who at one time was head of the country's central bank, is claiming that the Fijian government is trying to cover up a financial crisis at its national airline. With its entire fleet grounded, Fiji Airways has been in survival mode since May, when it sacked close to 800 employees. And now, as Kelvin Anthony reports, there are concerns that if international travel doesn't resume soon, the airline will go into administration.
Formerly the governor of the Reserve Bank, Savenatha Narumbe, says Fiji Airways is in deep trouble.
The lack of transparency from the airline. They have already asked for a bailout of $440 million by the Fiji government, and that has been granted. But anything more than that, we haven't got any details on from Fiji Airways. On that.
The national carrier has received a government lifeline to avoid defaulting on payments for its leased aircrafts worth 450 million Fijian dollars. But while global travel remains on hold, Mr. Narumbe, who is also the leader of Unity Fiji Party, says the company needs at least another $1 billion to bail it out.
We haven't got a full plan on how they're going to plug that big financial hole of $38 million a month going forward.
Just last week, Fiji's aviation minister, Aya Said Kayum, announced details of $1,000 payments for all dismissed Fiji Airways staff, while labeling claims from opposition politicians about the airline's true state as irresponsible. Mr. Narumbe says the money is good news for the employees, but a distraction from the real issue.
But it camouflages the cash flow issues that they face, which is quite deep. And we all know that even a profitable company can go under because of cash flow difficulties. And that's exactly their problem right now. So they don't hoodwink anybody by announcing a profit, which was for the last financial year, because that has got nothing to do to help them solve this cash flow problem.
Former Prime Ministers Sitiveni Rambuka and Mahendra Chaudhry have also weighed in on Fiji Airways' plight, which continues to make headlines in local media. Mr. Chaudhry says debt accumulated by Fiji Airways is a major concern.
I think they ventured into too many things all at once, and now it has taken its toll. The situation, of course, worsened and is beyond the control of the airline now, with restrictions which have come in the way of aviation industry by COVID-19. What they haven't yet announced, I have particularly been pressing for, is that they must develop a rescue plan, because once even after the flights are resumed, it will be a very changed market, and it will require cost saving in every possible area, because you won't get back to the volume.
Mr. Rambuka, who is also the leader of opposition in Parliament, believes Mr. Syed Kayum should take full responsibility.
All it needed was a very transparent statement to come out and allowing bipartisan approach in times of crisis, which all governments have done overseas, and we have done in Fiji in the past. At the moment, we're really in a very tight situation. There is no clause for Fiji Airways to return its leased aircraft, nor can they sell them outward to any other airline. But all the airlines are affected by the current restriction on international movement. So it'll be very difficult for Fiji Airways to get out of the situation, the crisis that it is in.
As the man once in charge of the Reserve Bank, Savenatha Narumbe, says, Fiji Airways numbers tell a grim story.
The government is now going to borrow 83% of GDP from 50-something to 30. It's a 30% increase, over 30% increase of borrowing as a percentage of GDP. And I'm looking at their revenue figures for this year, financial year. I doubt if they are going to raise the amount that they have budgeted. So you add on the bailout of Fiji Airways to that. If Fiji Airways is going to be bailed out by government, and I don't see any other shareholder coming to the rescue, I think they will have to cut and take a hit. They need to take a hit in these circumstances. They cannot get out of their court free and burden the people, because that is, to me, unsustainable.
Unity Fiji leader and former governor of the country's central bank, Savenatha Narumbe, ending that report from Kelvin Anthony. I'm Richard Ewart, and you're listening to Pacific Review. Papua New Guinea's capital, Port Moresby, has long been a melting pot for many of the country's 800 different tribes, and there's been some deep soul-searching since the news that a 19-year-old mother had been tortured and killed by her partner in the city went viral on social media. It's been the most highly publicised case, but it's by no means unique, and at City Hall, there's talk once again about getting to grips with gender-based violence, this time from a coalition of the willing. But as Bethany Harriman reports from Port Moresby, Papua New Guinea has been here before, and the prediction is that breaking the cycle will be an uphill battle.
It's been almost 2 months since the March Against Gender-Based Violence after the torture and death of Jenalyn Kennedy. Her partner, Bosib Kaiwi, has been charged with willful murder. Port Moresby has seen a number of well-documented gender-based violence cases. In 2018, 26-year-old Grace Guevara was allegedly beaten to death by her boyfriend, who was also arrested and charged with murder. Journalist Hannah Joku was more fortunate. She is a survivor of gender-based violence.
On 16th of September 2018, a complaint was laid with the police for an assault. An arrest was made. On August 16, 2019, my case was committed to national court. My perpetrator will stand trial for 2 counts of grievous bodily harm and 1 count of rape.
Ms. Joku is still waiting for the date for the pre-trial hearing. In the meantime, she is calling on politicians to take a lead in breaking the cycle of violence.
You want people to abide by the laws that you create, then you make sure the justice systems to support those laws work. My fight for justice is going on 2 years. I had to be strategic in staying alive long enough to be able to stand here today and tell you my story. I am Hannah Joku, and I'm someone's daughter. Tomorrow, it could be yours.
Port Moresby City Hall held a high-level meeting recently to come up with a strategy, and the chairman of the newly formed Coalition of the Willing, Governor Paul Sparkup, says MPs are now included.
Part of what we have resolved today is to set up a Coalition of the Willing. Ideally, we want all members of parliament, and especially on me and my co-chair's level, we want our governors to drive the agenda. But the reality is we have to start somewhere.
Governor Parkop says the challenge will be to change the behavior of Papua New Guineans.
That's not going to be easy, because behavior takes a lot of time to establish, habits as well. So changing behavior will take a long time, a lot of effort, and it will be a long journey. But the journey starts now.
Co-chairman and governor of East Sepik Province, Alan Bird, says this time members of parliament have the political freedom to help.
Major situations arise, COVID, you name it. We always wait for national government to take the first step. But I think what you'll notice is that in the last few years, the governors are stepping up a lot more. And we're shouldering the responsibility, you know, to demonstrate that rather than wait for a minister or wait for a department, many of us actually can, within our own ambit, do things.
It's estimated that more than two-thirds of women and girls in PNG experience gender-based abuse, or GBV, as it's often referred to now. And United Nations Resident Coordinator Gianluca Rampolla says the work to create a framework to deal with the issue has been slow.
We do have a national strategy, but that has not really been implemented in a coherent and comprehensive manner. And the National GBV Secretariat, which is being legislatively established, is not up and running. I'm looking at Secretary, because we're working together, and that's, again, part of the work we need to do together.
That's a reference to PNG's Community Development Department. Its Secretary, Anne Solomon Bai, says they're operating with limited funding, but she points to the root causes of gender-based violence of being gambling, extramarital affairs, and substance abuse.
We need to have genuine partnerships and genuine support going right down to our villages, utilizing our networks and our partners that are already there on the ground. All they need is a bit more support and a bit more push so that they're able to do their work well.
A new division will be set up to address gender-based violence, with Police Minister Brian Kremer, who is part of the Coalition of the Willing, saying it will be led by an assistant commissioner, who in turn will need good people behind him.
So we have a systems collapse through the entire system of Papua New Guinea, and this is why we're here today, but it's across the board, not just gender-based violence. We need to get good people back into the issues and dealing with these issues. So the focus now is we're going to have an ACP for family sexual violence. It's not formally part of the police structure and hasn't been for a long time. The only reason we have branches in every province is because, thanks to our aid partners and development partners like Australia and the EU, have been funding and setting it up.
And survivors like journalist Hannah Joku are urging the politicians to separate positive action from the rhetoric.
Papua New Guineans, we still, unfortunately, we still idolize politicians, and they have a massive impact, you know, in Moresby, especially over their Wantoks, their, you know, people from their home provinces. So anything and everything they say and do is taken at face value. And so they have to start putting actions behind some of these, issues. And GBV is, to me, is the biggest pandemic we have.
PNG journalist Hannah Joku, a survivor of domestic violence, and she was talking to Bethany Harriman in Port Moresby. And finally, where once there were two in Papua New Guinea, now there are three. I'm referring to think tanks, those bodies of experts who provide research, advice and ideas to power brokers on key political and economic issues of the day. For many years now, the government-funded National Research Institute and the largely independent Institute of National Affairs have held sway in PNG. But now there is a new kid on the block, PNG Think Tank Group, and it has the backing of the Prime Minister himself. A familiar theme in Papua New Guinea from the TV show Think Tank Quiz, in which pupils from primary schools across the country try to outsmart each other at general knowledge.
Yes, correct. B is the correct answer. All right.
And now at the adult level, the PNG Think Tank Group is keen not necessarily to outsmart its rivals, but certainly to demonstrate that it can influence government policy in ways it says those organisations cannot.
The PNG Think Tank Incorporated of Papua New Guinea.
At the group's official launch last year, founder and now interim executive director Samson Kamadi was nothing if not ambitious.
As a group with 1,000 members, 5,000 members, 500,000, or even 1 million membership, members that pay registration fees and are committed to a group, we can then speak one voice and we can influence the government.
And the then Energy Minister Sam Basil was on hand to offer his support.
I know that PNG Think Tank vision is an abstract from the PNG 2050 vision. To secure Papua New Guinea, where everyone is healthy, wealthy, secure, wise and peaceful.
18 months on, Think Tank Group hasn't come close to achieving its lofty membership ambitions, but Samson Kamadi does claim to have 3,000 professionals on board, including the Prime Minister and his deputy.
When O'Neill was the Prime Minister, I used to work with David Stevens, who's now the Deputy Prime Minister. And he was the first patron of the Think Tank Group, and he allowed this idea to flourish, and he gave his support. And then Marabe, David Stevens and Marabe, they paid their membership fees. It's these two guys that they think that is a right thing to do for the country here.
But the executive director of PNG's long-established Institute of National Affairs, Paul Barker, is sceptical. He suggests there are similarities between the think tank group and the online professional networking site LinkedIn, and he likens its membership base to Facebook friends.
The first big meeting, the PM gave quite a good address, and I think the other person who gave quite a good address was Ernie Gangloff, who's actually our INA president. And then there was a lot of going round and round in circles. So I know some of the people who attended that first meeting said, never again, I'm not going to it, it's just a talk shop. You know, a number of people have sort of said, it's not a think tank, it's a social gathering place. And I know that Ernie Gangloff has made the comment that if you're wanting to do research and get analysis, then you have to go to INA, to NRI. But as a venue for large gatherings and dialogue, politicians, a lot of ex-departmental heads and others, this think tank may have some sort of role in there.
Well, Paul Barker and Samson Kamati are at least in agreement on political involvement in the new group, with Mr. Kamati pointing to a power structure that features more than 20 government ministers, departmental secretaries, their deputies and company chief executives. By the end of August, the interim executive director expects to become permanent and appoint 4 full-time staff who, amongst other tasks, will assist in the monitoring of 25 WhatsApp discussion groups. Is the Prime Minister active in the WhatsApp groups?
He's active. I've included him in 2 groups. Every once in a while, he has free time. He writes to us and he addresses us directly to the think tank. And he said, I want help on this. You guys advise me on this, or this is what I'm doing. That's what he tells us.
And as well as being an active participant, Prime Minister Merape has pledged a large chunk of funding.
We requested Prime Minister for initial 2 million seed capital, and he approved. And Ministry of Treasury are putting into documentation an MOA, Memorandum of Agreement between think tank group to support the government. After we sign the MOA, it gives us the grounds to do a formal National Executive Council submission for the think tank group to be formally recognized. And she gives the note, we accept it. That automatically means that we are now allowed to be given a separate budget item.
The National Research Institute is also government funded, but Paul Barker's INA gets no regular money except to run CIMC, the Consultative Implementation and Monitoring Council, which is used as a vehicle for all sectors of society to present and discuss ideas, including the government itself. Mr. Barker says the think tank group has some work to do to justify the level of financial support.
In terms of anything that they've actually said or done, I certainly wouldn't describe them as providing cutting-edge ideas. They're going to say things that are going to please each other and engage. When it was being first set up, we were asked to just about sponsor them, help them get up and running. But we said, no, I think they can get up and running and we can engage. But I think we've got a bit of a different approach.
Another of Samson Kamati's ambitions centres on building a national database of professionals with university degrees. He says this would be a major point of difference to the INA, which he characterises as being focused on the business community, and the NRI, which he describes as a think tank for the public sector.
They will know exactly who are the experts, who are the professionals that they can rely on. They can get instant advice, ministers and department secretaries.
And right now there is a dialogue going on between think tank group and PNG's communications minister over a call for access to pornography on the internet to be banned.
We already have problems with sorcery, pedophilia and child molestation, and it just adds on to it. The materials that we posted on all the groups, I sent it straight to the Minister for Communications, Honourable Timothy Massieu, and Timothy Massieu said he's going to do a submission on this shortly.
Paul Barker doesn't agree that his organisation, the INA, does not have the ear of government too, but he says by using the discussion forum provided by the CIMC, they go about debating issues in a more balanced way.
We do say whenever the politicians want to make it too much of a platform for them, we always remind them, hang on, this is not just a platform for you, it's a platform for you to listen and for civil society to say its piece and the private sector to say its piece. Yeah, it's a platform for all voices to be heard. Whereas this think tank thing, I think, is going out of its way to be on the side of the government, to use that as a means to be heard by government.
However, Samson Kamati is painting the think tank group as an organisation with all sides of politics represented, and one that he says will go about its business in the Melanesian way.
In Papua New Guinea, the politicians have a short span of attention. Their ego is very big. A lot of people worship him. They're like cult figures. So when you as a think tank group, like NRI and INA, they do not get along with the politicians very easily because they attack the politicians. And then the politicians say, okay, you guys with your ideas, you can get lost. So my approach with the think tank group is this. We work very closely with the politicians, and we politely say that, okay, this is good issue, but it will go wrong because it will do this and this. If we take this course, we will come to this, and these are good benefits to the country. And then we put it in formal submission. We sit down with them, have coffee, and we present it to them. So we are blending a Melanesian way of approaching intellectual discussions, but we are sensitive towards the feelings of the politicians, because this country will change only through political will. If the political will is not there, forget all the research that we are going to do. Whoever funds it, we don't care. It will just collect dust.
And that report on the aspirations of the PNG Think Tank Group rounds out this edition of Pacific Review. I'm Richard Hewitt. Thank you very much for listening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.